Welcome to Hollywood and Horsepower, the show about the story behind the story. Today, we are joined by a very special guest, a good friend of mine and part of this show, Anthony Big A Stabile. Anthony's been on the show before. You've heard me talk about him. He's family. We really have a lot of fun together. So, Anthony, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mark. What's happening?
How's the Big A today?
Doing all right. Getting ready to wrap up this gig up at Finger Lakes Gaming and Racetrack. Announcing up there a handful of weeks left in the season. We wrap things up on Thanksgiving Eve, Wednesday, November 27th. And the Breeders' Cup, which is our World Series Super Bowl in horse racing, if you will,
kicks off
right around the corner. Yeah, November 1st and 2nd over at Del Mar out in Southern
first
California,
weekend in
San Diego.
And isn't the Breeders' Cup always the first weekend in November?
No, it falls weird on the calendar. Everything basically goes by however the Derby falls. So the Derby's always the first Saturday in May, and that obviously can range from the 1st of May till the 7th of May. So everything kind of goes from there. I guess you could say how the calendar itself falls, but really it's how the Derby falls, and then it kind of goes from there.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. So the Derby kind of sets the calendar for the rest of the year.
Yes and no. They're usually 6 weeks apart. Because when I was younger and trying to change things, I had this idea of trying to put a system together. I'm a very big believer in it. There's a lot of pros and cons to the Breeders' Cup. It's a story for another day. But what I wanted to do years ago, I wanted to put it in one place. I wanted to put it at Churchill Downs. Just because of there's this lack of a bias at Churchill Downs, both for the horses on the track and the atmosphere and just acclimating to the environment and stuff. It's kind of a neutral site for all the horses, both the Europeans and Japanese and the locals. And the courses are built to handle the intended distances for the races. And I wanted to run this series where the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, so the two-year-olds, and then you have the Derby is 6 months later, and then 6 months after that is the Breeders' Cup again. I wanted to run this Juvenile Derby classic, triple crown, if you will. But everybody looked at me like I was crazy, like they usually do. So it never really...
But that is interesting, and for people joining us that are outside of horse racing, the Breeders' Cup, you know, everybody knows the Kentucky Derby, but the Breeders' Cup is the world championship. The difference being, right, Kentucky Derby does have international horses, but it is three-year-olds, and it is predominantly U.S. male horses, and then a bunch of undercard races. The Breeders' Cup is the world championship, and you have races for horses of all different ages and horses from all over the world. And it really, I mean, to me, it is a real elegant day of racing, for lack of better words. Really surrounded
nowadays
with like hospitality. Go ahead.
Nowadays, when it's now 2 days. When it first started, the first Breeders' Cup was held on November 10th,
1984. Okay.
These will be the 41st annual
in Hollywood Park.
Breeders' Cup. Hollywood Park doesn't exist anymore. The brainchild mostly of John Gaines. And a bunch of breeders who got together and decided we needed a day to celebrate the sport. And the original seven races were the Classic, the Distaff, the Juvenile Fillies, the Mile, the Sprint, and the Turf. And the Mile and the Turf were both run on the grass, and the other five races were run on the dirt. And it is now turned into a two-day 14-race extravaganza. They've actually pulled the plug on two other races. There was a juvenile sprint on the dirt, and there was a marathon race. And they actually pulled the plug on those after a handful of years of trying those. But, you know, so technically if everything would have stayed in play and they would have added the new one, there would be 16 races. And it basically covers all of the divisions in the sport. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun. They're two really good days of racing. like you said, the Derby, Belmont Stakes, the Travers, all those big races, the Preakness, they have the undercard for the day. There really is no undercard here. They're all important races.
They're all A-list races. It's true.
Yeah, and they all decide divisional, for the most part, decide year-end divisional honor. So,
and it's cool. Yeah. For people who have never been, I really encourage people to look at it because it's a unique 2 days of racing in the sense that it's very accessible, especially, in my opinion, when it's at Santa Anita. You get the feeling like you can just kind of mingle around and, you know, you're walking down the aisle and there's Bo Derek, or you're walking down the aisle and here's some other celebrity. It's just very accessible racing. And then it's also, you know, really the top of everything in the world. So it's very much an international event. You know, you have horses from all over the world, owners and trainers from all over the world. And that, to me, has always been very interesting. Did you ever go to Hollywood Park?
No. I've never flown in an airplane. I've been in one that didn't take off. And
I remember that.
I haven't tried again since.
And you never drove out there.
Wednesday of 2022. No, never drove to Cali. The only place
Great American Road Trip.
Yeah, no, I haven't done it. The only Breeders' Cup I've been to, have been here in New York, and then one in Churchill Downs in 2018 when we were doing EquestriCon. I was working with you.
Yep.
And that was
Churchill Downs.
That was part of my, that year at Churchill, it was a lot of fun. And that year at Churchill, I had kicked that idea around in my head. And that year at Churchill kind of solidified it because it goes off without a hitch. And there are two, it's a weird setup too, because the Breeders' Cup, you know, when you're in the World Series, and that's a little bit of a raw point right now because my Mets got eliminated in the League Championship Series, but.
Well, here's what everybody's telling
year.
Me. The great Dodgers year. Used to be from Brooklyn, so everybody says they're going to side with the Dodgers.
No, it's not. I am jokingly, I told my friends I'm rooting for the return of Ricketts. I really can't. I can't have a dog in that fight emotionally. But you know, like, so the Dodgers and Yankees are playing in the World Series. So when the Yankees have their home games, the Yankees will run Yankee Stadium, the new Yankee Stadium. The Breeders' Cup comes in and takes everything over. So when they go to Santa Anita doesn't run it. The Breeders' Cup runs it. So it's a very good point. It's a unique business, and Breeders' Cup makes all the money too. So it's a unique business model because it's basically just like, hey, we're going to give you the honor of running this. You're not really going to make any money. It might cost you a few dollars at the end of the day, but you're going to have the prestige of hosting these championships, and we're going to settle all the year-end honors here. So it's a different business.
And I will say, having been involved in it as a sponsor, you know, we're representing several different companies, I've always been impressed. Having worked with almost every racetrack in the greater 48 and a few in the UK on different types of events and different types of sponsorships, I have to say my experience with Breeders' Cup was always positive. They always did well. I mean, I'm not perfect. Nobody's perfect. Anybody that tells you their event was perfect has not done many events. But they are, I always felt really good about it, better than I did at a lot of other large events. In fact, some that are considered larger. So yeah, I do have to give them credit. You know, you're absolutely right. And I think most people don't realize this. When Breeders' Cup comes in, they take over the track. They manage the people. They manage all the hospitality, the food, the racing. Everything is handled by them. The racetrack is just kind of turns it over to them.
And I'm kind of surprised, you know, I know we don't have the I know we have a gigantic fan base, but I know that we're not as popular as the Major Four and soccer and other things. I'm actually surprised that the other associations and leagues didn't try to follow suit here, and that Major League Baseball didn't say, hey, you know what, we're going to come in and take this over a little bit. I know the Super Bowl, the NFL, obviously, they have a more hands-on approach because it is at a neutral site for the most part, right? That you can, of course, have it in Miami, and maybe one year the Dolphins will return, and it'll just be coincidental. But I know the NFL does it a little bit. They kind of do it with their all-star weekends. I know, like, here in, I remember when the Mets hosted the city, when Citi Field was only like 4 or 5 years old, they hosted the all-star game. I believe it was 2013, and one of the Mets actually started, Matt Harvey. MLB comes in and takes over a little bit. But the fact that they haven't, that a lot of these organizations and associations haven't followed that business model a little bit to, you know, kind of line the pockets, not just for the teams, but for the league itself, surprised me, because it does seem, I don't know how happy the tracks are, but it does, like you said, it does seem to work for the event itself. You very rarely hear of somebody say, I went to the Breeders' Cup and I had a bad experience. That is not the case. Not the case in single day events at particular rate. I don't want to start raking anybody over the coals here, but that's not the case on an annual basis for some of the other big days of the year. Like I said, for some reason, I noticed, and I was at Churchill, when I was at Churchill in 2018, it seemed to go off like a regular day, and there were 50,000 there Friday and Saturday. So it impressed me to the point where I was just like, why don't we just leave this thing here? It's a traveling circus. Leave it here. They like having it here. Breeders' Cup's headquarters are in Lexington. Like, just leave it here and let them figure it out. And I think if you established a home, and I was wrong, because the original concept was for it to travel. But in recent years, you know, Santa Anita's at 11 or 12 and Churchill's at 10 or 11. It's the kind of thing where I think keeping
it. And I will say, Santa Anita did an amazing job too. One of the things that I liked when it was at Santa Anita, and even at Del Mar, I liked that as well, was it didn't feel, it felt very relaxed. It was very laid back, and it was very easy to navigate. Like, parking was easy, getting in and out was easy. It felt like a Wednesday at the races. It didn't feel like you're going to a world event where you're, you know, like, the one thing I remember from Breeders' Cup was when it was at Churchill, you had to make some arrangements ahead of time to get in and out of there. Traffic was kind of horrific, especially going out. And, you know, that's always been a problem with Churchill. Same thing with the Derby. You know, I've kind of got it down now because I know some of the back streets that you can get out, snake your way out, jump on the highway. But if you're just in there, you know, if you don't go there a lot, that can be a nightmare. But I do agree with you. It is kind of interesting that I can see both sides. You know, the other one I would say that's kind of similar is probably World Cup in soccer. You know, like, they come to Miami and it kind of floats around, and that's the same way when they do their thing. It's like they kind of take over.
The funny thing for me is there hasn't been a Breeders' Cup at Belmont in New York since 2005. And
why is that?
Well, NYRA was, the Racing Association was in some transition, and I think there was some question as to whether we were able to handle the event here in New York. And now, once the new Belmont goes up in the next handful of years, I believe it'll be here.
That's what I was going to ask you, if you thought it would go there once the new Belmont opens.
Yeah, I can't imagine there'll be a British appeal later than 2028. But in 2005, we were having some issues with the house. There was some flooding because we had a ton of rain that October, and we couldn't really. I didn't make it out to Belmont that day, and it may be just when you were talking just now, I haven't been to a Breeders' Cup as a fan since 1995. The other few I've been to, I've been working. So I don't encounter those problems. Like, it's easy for me to get around because I have my all access badge and pass, but I don't have to worry about the traffic getting out of there, because I don't leave for an hour.
To the track and out.
Oh, I don't leave for an hour.
I don't have a private helicopter like you do.
There's no private helicopter. I'm working. So if I get there an hour and a half, 2 hours early in the morning, you know, some of those mornings we would do those countdown shows. I'd be there at 6 o'clock. I don't leave till 7, 8 o'clock. Got to wrap the equipment up and dot the I's and cross the T's. So, you know, I say to myself, what traffic was this guy sitting in? And then it dawned on me, I don't leave till an hour and a half until the event's over.
Yeah,
so,
which is probably smart because, you know, if you had, and I have actually done that before at Derby, probably the most relaxed day I had at Derby. The weather was fairly nice. Can't remember what year it was. It might have been 17 or 18, Justify or something. But we just didn't leave. We let everybody clear out, sat there on the lawn, and then wandered out. It was painless. And that really was the problem you run into, at least with Derby, not so much with Breeders' Cup, but when they have it in Kentucky, you know, you just never know what the weather's going to be like. It's like when it was at Keeneland, one day was beautiful. The next day, that was when Pharaoh ran, and I was there. Bob Baffert was gracious enough to kind of let us tag along with him, and we had several sponsorship things going on. And it was beautiful on Friday. Saturday, freezing cold and raining sideways. And it was just kind of crazy. And that's unfortunately what you run into when it's in Kentucky. You just don't know what you're going to have. You could have snow, you could have 80-degree weather.
Yeah, you could have anything. Having that credential really pays off, like when you're in the industry. And because I think there, for me anyway, like, and it happens a lot, I think, in Saratoga. It happens to me at Saratoga more often than anywhere else because I remember at Belmont Stakes, it was actually the last Belmont Stakes I covered for Naira in 2022. I remember Friday night, the place had let out. And this is probably one of the most memorable moments I spent at Belmont Park before they tore it down. I remember everybody out Friday night, and I was there a little late, just wrapping up my duties and getting things ready for Saturday. And I left the set, and there was this just like beautiful sunset. And it was probably like around 7:30, and the sky was this purple and orange and blue, and the sun was like fighting to stay up in the sky. And it was just like, you know, there's nobody around except some of your coworkers and maybe the cleaning crew. And it's just like, I get to do this every day. Like, I get to come do this every day. And then the practicality of the kick in when you're walking out, you're like, I don't got to fit in that traffic getting out of here. I've got to get the traffic getting out of here either. But it's like, those moments hit you. They hit you a lot in Saratoga, too, because you'll be wrapping the day up, and there'll have been 35, 40,000 people there just 3 hours earlier. And you'll look down, and the place is quiet, and maybe you're in the press box, and you pop the beer open, and you're having a pop with some of your brethren there. And you're looking around at a place that was just like fived out and yelling and screaming and shaking. It's like its own being. There's this quiet and this beauty and this serenity to it. Those are some of my favorite moments especially after those big days, like after a Travers Day, you know, walking out of Saratoga at like 9 o'clock is really a real special feeling. So not only do you get the benefits of not having to deal with traffic, but you get those real special moments. But as far as being a fan, I don't know what it's like being at the Breeders' Cup as a fan. It's been 30 years since Seagal.
You know what's funny? I don't either, because every time that I've gone, I've been working.
Yeah.
So I've always been to represent somebody, or I had guests. I mean, the craziest time I had, one time I had guests in three different dining rooms. So I was floating all over the place. So it's usually a really busy day, and I agree with you. You know, the other thing that hit me when you talked about the serenity thing, especially at Churchill and Santa Anita, well, and even Del Mar, and probably because there's so much memorabilia hanging around, but it really kind of hits you, like at the end of the day, if you hang around to where everybody's left and you're walking out and you start looking at pictures and you start looking at some of the nameplates and you think, these people and these horses, everybody from, Bing Crosby to, you know, even the current day, you know, Chad Brown, Bob Barrett, they walk these halls. The horses, even Secretariat, and even before him, walk these tunnels. And I don't know, it just kind of hits you, the history of it. That is one thing that I really, really like about Santa Anita and Churchill, is just wandering around looking at everything, and you can still see the pieces that probably still look like they did in 1940.
Yeah, that's what Belmont Park brought. Belmont Park, I just tell people all the time, you know, several girls that I've dated, like, you don't have a lot of culture. You don't, you know, museums. It's like, I go to the best museum every day. I go to the best museum 4 days a week on Long Island. Belmont Park's the best museum. It was, anyway. I'll be curious to see what the new place looks like.
Anthony, we're going to take a quick break right here, and then we'll be back to finish what we were talking about. I want to take a moment to, you know, call out some of the people that make this possible and some of the people that we support. So the top of that list, which everybody knows has become a very key part of this show, is No Fallen Heroes. What makes No Fallen Heroes unique is No Fallen Heroes Foundation, which you can find at nofallenheroesfoundation.org, was started by a Top Gun pilot, Matt Wiz Buckley, a friend of this show. And what's different is they help everybody from first responders to veterans to people who are active duty to the families of veterans and first responders. Being somebody who came through a Navy background and having some issues I had to work through myself, not being able to fly when that was a lifelong dream, I was still able to go on and fly privately and commercial, but I wasn't able to fly Navy, and that was, as many know, you know, my dream. I went through 18 months of NAVCAD, and, you know, you wake up one day and you're just done. You know, it's a definite transition, and some guys work through it, some guys have a really hard time. No Fallen Heroes has done a tremendous job of helping the people that have protected us. So if you get a chance, take a look at them. It's a great foundation run by a great guy, Matt Wisbrook. Which brings us to another thing I'd like to point out. Matt also does keynote speaking. So if your company has a conference or anything coming up, please take a moment and go to Wiz Buckley, WHIZBUCKLEY.com, and take a look at Matt as a keynote speaker. You couldn't ask for a better speaker, and how many times can you have a decorated Top Gun pilot in your midst to talk to your team? He's a very interesting guy. He's had a very colorful career, including being one of the pilots that was on the tarmac waiting to go on 9/11. So if your company's looking for a keynote speaker, he is definitely somebody you want to take a look at. WizBuckley.com. And another person along that line, if your company is struggling with benefits, there is only one person in this country, in my opinion, that you should be talking to. And that is MB Gray. MBGrayHealthcare.com will take you to her website. She is the best of the best. If there was a Top Gun for healthcare consultants, she would be the commander of the program. Again, an excellent keynote speaker. And in my mind, I have watched her work. I have seen the benefits of her work. She is one of the people that everyone wins. I always say the best deal is the deal that everybody walks away a winner. And MB Gray is that person that puts programs together that benefit the company, the employees, and even the insurance company. So if your company is struggling with benefits, which over the last few years, I guarantee everybody is, take a moment, take a look at her website. I promise you, you won't be sorry. So now back to the show. We're going to go back and pick up where we left off with Anthony. And we appreciate you joining us. This is Hollywood and Horsepower, and we are joined today by Anthony Big A Stabile. for those just joining us, I'm with Anthony Big A Stabile, and we are talking everything from Breeders' Cup to restaurants and where we like to go after the races. We want to take a moment and talk about some of the things that are near and dear to this show, not the least of which is No Fallen Heroes. So for anybody who knows much about me, you know, I started out my career to be a Navy fighter pilot, went through NAVCAD, class of 89, didn't make it to the fleet, but I've always been a supporter. And I was fortunate enough to get to meet Matt Wiz Buckley. Matt is a Top Gun graduate. He is real life fighter pilot, flew an F-A-18. He was on deck on 9/11 to defend our country. After he got out of the Navy, he went on to start a group called No Fallen Heroes. And I would encourage people to take a minute, go take a look at their website, nofallenheroes.org. They help everybody from first responders to veterans. And our goal is to stop veteran and first responder suicide. We are losing, depending on the report you look at, we're losing between 50 and 52 of these men and women a day, and one is too many. So, you know, please take a look, do what you can, and we really, really appreciate it. And this show does not get any sponsorship money or anything for No Fallen Heroes. We support them because we believe in them. It is founded by a Navy fighter pilot for veterans by veterans. So, nofallenheroes.org, and, you know, we appreciate you guys doing anything you can. So, Anthony, welcome back to the show. We were in the middle of talking Breeders' Cup and talking about Belmont and what we thought was going to happen after they come back. You know, one of the things I've always been curious about, I'd love to hear your, you know, memories on this. What is your most memorable Breeders' Cup race?
Wow.
I mean, you're the horse guy. You know.
So it's weird because, you know, when you ask that question, it's, I think everybody knee-jerk in the business, or if you're a horse racing fan, is to be the biggest score you made.
Oh, that makes sense. So, handicap.
It's not for me. I remember the last time I was there as a fan, October 28th, 1995, beautiful Belmont Park. Cigar was looking to put the cap on a perfect 10-for-10 season. And as, you know, I'm not a big chalk guy, so I bet a few bucks on a horse named French Deputy against him. I had a great couple of days gambling, like a real good couple of days gambling. The day before Cigar won, for Hall of Fame of Belmont and the late Alan Paulson, they ran a first-time starter named Rob in the first race on Friday. And I left St. John's. I cut my last class to make sure I was at Belmont early enough to absolutely destroy Rob at the windows. And he paid $1,560, and I made a ton of money. And then a horse in the last race named Groucho Gaucho, we had a tip on him, and he won. And I remember being with my friend Alex DeRosa, may he rest in peace. Alex died a few years later in a car accident, and he was young. He was in his early 20s like I was at the time. We had waited to bet on Groucho Gaucho for about a month and a half, and when he won, we were running so fast to go downstairs and take the picture that we started tripping over each other, and there was like a four-man pile on the second floor of Belmont Park, and we had run down the steps to the winner's circle. It was pretty hysterical. Great memory.
That's amazing.
But I made a lot of money the day before the Breeders' Cup. This one, it was still just one day, seven races. Made a bunch of money that first day, the Friday, and then cleaned up the first half of the card on Saturday. And, you know, you knew you were watching something special with Cigar, but from the gambler, I was like, well, French Deputy 12-1, I'm going to take a little shot with him. And he didn't run any good. I made a score with him on Labor Day that year. So I remember, I when I was younger, I wasn't big on watching the races live. I used to watch them on TV at the track. I used to just like being at the racetrack. But I remember saying to myself, I want to go see this. And much like this year, this year's Breeders' Cup Classic is going to be run in the middle of the day on Saturday because of contractual obligations. I think it's with the Big Ten. Back then it was Notre Dame. NBC had a show every Notre Dame game. So instead of starting the day at 12:30, we started Breeders' Cup Day at 10:30 in the morning. And the Classic was being run somewhere in the 3:15 range, 3:30, so that they could be off the air for Notre Dame at 4 o'clock. And, you know, it was one of those late October. And it was like in the 50s. It was a nice day. It was some really crappy weather. Yeah, it was a little crisp. And Belmont, if it's 55 at Belmont, it feels like it's 45. And I remember saying to myself, go watch this outside. Pretty much knew that it was going to be a donation, betting on French Deputy. go watch this outside. And I've been running around that place since I'm a kid. So I went to one of the white caps and I was like, Hector, let me just come on. And I was up against the fence on the second floor in the boxes. And he splashed home right in front of me. He was, you know, I mean, I was right on the wire. And Bailey put his finger up and started wagging his finger. And you just saw him around the racetrack. Like, the second floor of Belmont was a pretty good view. It was over the tote board and stuff. And you could just see he was laying fourth outside most of the way. And, you know, just sitting there. And you could hear Tom Durkin, the greatest, you know, the pent-up power of cigar. Bailey says, no, not yet. And then when he turns him loose, approaching the far turn, you know, Tom rushes his way through the rest of the field. He was sitting third, going to the far turn. There was about 45 seconds left to the race. And Tom just rattles through the last four horses. I don't remember the four horses off the top of my head. Cigar! There goes Cigar! And he brushed to the lead. And then he's in front by himself the rest of the way. Probably just a couple of lengths, but he's by himself. And you could just see him finishing the season. And my father's a horse trainer, my favorite trainer of all time, Bill Mott. So to see Cigar win the Classic the way he did and cap off this perfect season, 10 for 10, we hadn't seen an undefeated season from a superstar like that since Personal Ensign 7 years earlier, back in 1988. And it was just, like, so cool to watch that race that, for me, you know, tore my tickets up, didn't cash a ticket. That will probably always be. It's going to be really hard to top that. Just from history, right? It's one of the most famous race calls of all time. And here he is, the unconquerable, invincible, unbeatable Cigar. For years, Cigar is buried at Kentucky Horse Park.
Yeah.
And there are two monuments to him. That call's so memorable, and it's so widely discussed because people originally thought Tom said incomparable. And there are two different stones there, and one says incomparable, invincible, unbeatable Cigar. And the other says what Tom really said, unconquerable, invincible, unbeatable Cigar. Yeah, they're
those
both
are the
there.
Stories that really make this sport fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, I'm living my dream being a racetrack announcer now. That's all I ever wanted to do since I was 8 or 9 years old. And I was obsessed with Tom Durkin. And Tom would, you know, when Tom found out about that, Tom always encouraged me and tried to help me. And I did my first term paper on Tom, and I had a tape recorder with me. And we recorded for 55 minutes, and I didn't check my levels. And I did not get one word. And I went back to him the next day. I did not get one word. And I went back to him the next day. I was like, Tom, I'm so sorry. He never said a word. He sat down. We tested the tape recorder, and he did it again. And I was just like, this guy has a lot better things to do than to give some bratty 13-year-old an hour of his time 2 days in a row because he was a schmuck the first day and didn't check his tape recorder when he wants to be a journalist. And, you know, and he was just, it was so cool that he did that the second time. And like, that's all I ever wanted to do. So I nerd out.
But you know what's funny? I find that same thing to be true about a lot of people in this business. I mean, I feel like that sitting here talking to you. I feel like that with every guest I have.
I appreciate that, but that's ridiculous.
No, but I'm dead serious. I feel like that with every guest I have that I think, you know, why is this guy wasting his time with a schmuck like me? And everybody is very gracious, always willing to take the time and talk to you. And I have found, for the most part, that is how people are. I remember one time, and I've always, you know this, Bob Baffert, I consider a personal friend. I admire him. I think he's just a good guy. He's a good person. I'd argue that with anybody. Bob, one time, he came and did an event for me, and we give him an award and everything, but it was like, same thing. I mean, it's like, this guy's got 8 million other things he could be doing. And he took the time to not only come, which was out of his way, but he spent a bunch of time there, and he signed autographs for all the people. He took pictures with anybody that wanted to. It was the most gracious thing I've ever seen, and there wasn't a dime in it for him. He just did it, you know, to be nice. And I said to him, I kind of fallen all over myself, and he said, hey, he said, you know, I'm just happy that people want to come. You know, he was absolutely gracious. And I've found that time and time and time again. You know, I walk up and talk to people, everybody from Jack Vandenberg to Randy Romero when he was with us. And, you know, they even, you know, the big guys like, you know, Lafitte Pakai and, you know, Senior. And, you know, they take the time to talk to you, and it always kind of amazes.
So I
think that is something cool about this sport.
I was with a girl for 14 years on and off.
I find it hard to believe. Totally 14 years, one girl?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, the first 12 was one girl, and then we had a really good, the ending got weird. Yeah, 100%. And believe me, there was plenty to vulture over. He was a huge New Kids on the Block fan, the boy band from the late 80s. And they got back together 20 years after they broke up in 2008. And they went, and of course, you know, the man that was actually responsible, and I would say the most famous of the New Kids, there's five of them, is Donnie Wahlberg.
Sure.
You know, accomplished actor, Blue Bloods for 15 seasons, which is wrapping up
excellent
this year.
Excellent hamburger maker.
The Wahlbergers are fantastic. Yep. Partners with his brothers, Paul and Mark, of course. And I remember she wanted to go see them at a meet and greet in a Walmart on Long Island. And I go to this meet and greet, and it's 2008, and the Mets are in the middle of another meltdown to the Phillies. And I go to this meet and greet, and I wait online for about 3 hours to get in. And it's 98% girls, 2% guys. And I'm waiting on this line to get in, and we get in, and we're getting closer to them. And there was this look, and they're just being so gracious. And all five New Kids on the Block are there, and they're just being so gracious. But Donnie Wahlberg kind of stuck out the most. And we're maybe 7 or 8 people from the line. And he's being nice and cordial and everything. And he sees me, and he sees testosterone. He must have said to himself, thank God. And I got my Mets T-shirt on, and he's like, 86 replay this year? Because the Mets beat the Red Sox, and they're from Boston. The Mets beat the Red Sox in the 86 World Series. And I was like, I hope so, man. And we literally start talking baseball the entire time. We go around this line, and we're talking the whole time until I'm back out of view. Good 10-minute conversation with him and one of the other New Kids, a guy named Joey McIntyre. So we have this conversation. 2 years later, they come back to Long Island. They do a documentary. She gets them. I get her to meet them again. She gets pictures with all five. She's ecstatic about the whole thing. 2012, her and I are no longer together, but we're still friends. And they're doing this meet and greet thing. They're calling them town hall meetings, and they're going around talking to fans. And you know, they weren't making any money. It was basically giving tickets away. And at this time, I'm not working. I had 5 years at the Post under my belt. But now I'm a stay-at-home son, as I like to joke. I'm not working. I'm hustling. I'm trying to get back into the business. But I'm watching these guys, and I'm like, man, this Donnie Wahlberg really knows how to treat his fans. So we go to this thing in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is about an hour and a half from me, hour and 20 minutes. We go up there. And, you know, I goof around and I make this sign that says, I'm a Donnie girl, to try to get his attention. And everybody laughs and they get my attention. I walk back up. He calls me up to the front of the stage and we're talking. And, you know, I do this whole thing. I tell him I'm not with the girl anymore, but we're there together. And he asked if I cheated. And I said, no, I just screwed up and this and this. And he's trying to get us back. He's literally, Donnie Wahlberg, standing in front of 500 other people trying to get me and my ex back together. And it's, you know, it's great. It's fun. We made the local newspaper, the whole thing. The moral of the story is when the event's over, he comes walking over to me and he looks at me and he goes, you and I talked about the Mets and the Red Sox once. I was just like, yeah, in the East Meadow Walmart, when you guys first got back together, he's like, yeah, it was September and they were in the middle of that collapse. This is 3.5 years later.
I think that's a sign of a true professional.
This guy remembered a Mets-Red Sox conversation with
him. I've had the same thing. I've seen the same thing where people I've met several years later. In fact, it's funny. Grace, my daughter, always says, no matter where we go, people know you. They remember you. And it is kind of funny, but I think that's a sign of a true professional. I mean, I've seen that, you know, again.
I remember saying to myself that day, if I ever have a modicum of this guy, so he followed Christine, her name was Christine, is, I'm sure she's still alive, followed her back on Twitter, sent her a direct message, when you guys get married, me and Jenny, he's married to Jenny McCarthy, Jenny and I'll be there, kept in touch with her. I remember saying to myself, man, if I ever have a modicum of this guy's success,
there's a lot to be learned.
Because, you know, horse racing is kind of like a fishbowl a little bit, right? You can be, this sounds conceited. I sound like Ron Burgundy here, but in horse racing, I'm kind of a big deal. So I've always made sure to treat fans, followers on Twitter. I'm friends with guys and gals I've met on social media and met out at the racetrack. Break bread with them. I had one guy stay in my condo in Saratoga 2 summers ago when he couldn't find a hotel room. Like, you have to do that. You have to be accessible. You have to give back. You have to be friendly, because without the fans,
there's
and horse racing is a little different. Without the owners and the gamblers, the owners never get enough credit. Without the owners and the gamblers, there's no horse racing.
There's a lot to be said for that, because there is no mathematical equation that you can make sense for purchasing a racehorse. It's something you have to want to do.
Just do what it is. That's the truest thing, sir, you have ever said. That's the truest thing you've ever said.
There's no question. I mean, it's one of those things where you have to want to do it. So you're absolutely right. The owners deserve a lot of credit. It is definitely a business of passion. You love this. And I think that is also what makes it so live, accessible in a way, is that, you know, enthusiasm breeds enthusiasm. So if you enjoy something, if you like something, the natural thing is to share it with people. It's what, I mean, let's face it, that's what shows like this are based on. It's a bunch of people sitting around talking. You know what I mean? All we're doing is telling stories, and people love it. And, you know, I love it. I listen to other people's shows. I mean, and that's what, but I think that in horse racing, that is what it makes it accessible is the enthusiasm. People are excited and they want to share it with other people. The vast majority, you know, there's exceptions, but I would say the vast majority of this sport, very gracious, very down to earth. And I tell people all the time, it is the most accessible sport, and I work in almost all of them. You aren't going to walk out to the edge of the rail on the bottom section of an NFL game and run into the owner very often. You will in horse racing. You know what I mean? You aren't going to be wandering through the tunnel to get a hot dog or something and bump into, you know, a head coach. You will bump into Bob Baffert. You know, so there's, and he'll stop and talk to you, you know, so it's definitely one of those industries that's very accessible. The people are very gracious. I do have to tell you my favorite Breeders' Cup story, though, back where we started. Beholder and Songbird. And for me, like what you were talking
about. I'm tuning out to this, by the way. Just
stop
like,
it now.
I will not.
So I'll tell you why. Hear me out. You know I'm not a handicapper guy.
She's my favorite Philly of all time. I will not listen to this blasphemy.
You're going to have to listen to it. So I like Gary Stevens, and I like Mike Smith. I like them both. And I know people like one or the other. I like them both. I like them both equally. They're great guys. We were fortunate enough. Mike was actually on the show with us last week. And they're just tremendous people. But what's funny is they would end up going up against each other. And that was kind of the culmination of that rivalry. And it ends with a nose out, you know, race, which I thought was kind of cool. But it was just a fun day, and I happened to be there to see it. And I think those are the ones you remember. You know, it's something, like you said, with Cigar. You're there. It's kind of like American Pharoah. When American Pharoah won the Triple Crown, I was on the second floor at Belmont. But again, Bob Baffert was kind enough to take myself and Michael Blowen, let us tag along with him. And we're there, and we get to see it. You never forget where you were. I can still picture that moment. You can picture that moment standing down in the winner's circle with 40,000 of your friends. You know?
Still trying to shake the Beholder Songbird photo for my head. I'm sorry.
You have to admit, that was a cool race.
That would have been nothing. You see, this is the thing. When you're a lifer, you will, and I am a passionate person about my favorites.
Who was it? So why do you hate that race? Who's
I don't hate it because I love Songbird. I'm the biggest. Songbird's my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Songbird is my, Songbird is my absolute favorite filly of all time. My favorite horse of all time is Tonalist, and we told that story last time.
And that was kind of a fluke in my mind. I mean, I thought Songbird was going to win.
He came along right after Tonalist was kind of done. Tonalist retired November 28th, 2015 was his last race. He won the Cigar Mile here at Aqueduct. She won her Breeders' Cup race 4 weeks earlier on Halloween in the Juvenile Fillies. So Tonalist retires, and she becomes my favorite of the moment. And so throughout 16, you know, and she was undefeated going into that Breeders' Cup. And I was at a casino, not Mohegan Sun in Connecticut. And I was alive for some money. I was alive for some money. But the money, you could have had the money. Just give me that phone. Just flip that nose.
I'm surprised somebody hasn't made a T-shirt that says I'm still alive in the pick six, pick three. Because you hear that 20 times a day at a racetrack. I'm still alive in the pick three.
Nah, I can't believe you brought up Songbird. Oh, my God. I cannot believe
you know what's funny to me? So from my side.
Really just
so from my side, I'm a West Coast guy. I'm definitely a California guy. Oh. And I like Santa Anita. I like both of those guys. I really didn't have a favorite. I just liked the fact that it was such a dogfight right to the end. I mean, they fought
Everybody
it out.
Thought
they
I was crazy. I thought she was the best filly since Ruffian. I thought that highly of Songbird. Like
I think she was a good filly. I just think it was just happened to be Beholder's. I mean, you know what it is. It's a stride thing. Maybe 10 feet before that, you know,
and
it's
a head bob. I remember the next year she came to Saratoga and she had a little bit of a trimmed campaign. She won the Ogden Phipps at Belmont and then she won another race and she came to Saratoga to run in the personal ensign and she ran in a four horse field and she got run down by Forever Unbridled to go on to win the Breeders' Cup. And, she came out of the race, and Sunday, an old friend of mine who was working for Naira at the time, who we were at the old HRN radio broadcast booth, on Sundays we would hang out. There was no work. and everybody was still there, and we're getting ready to wrap up from Trapper Day the day before, and we're all there, and we're having, you know, a little bit of like a wrap party, because when we did the radio, as you know, we didn't see each other all the time, and I probably wasn't going to see my coworkers from radio until the following Belmont, so 9 months, 8 months. So we're all there. We got a couple of bottles, and we're eating, we're drinking. I had promised Christine that we would go walk around Saratoga that afternoon. But then we wound up staying, and my old friend Anthony pulls up, and he's like, hey, I got the golf cart. I talked to Jerry Hollendorfer's people. You can go see Songbird if you want. And I was just like, well, I was like, you want to talk about being starstruck? I still have the pictures on my phone. I have some great shots with her. I always put it up every year on her birthday, April 30th. And we rode back there, and for 20 minutes, you want to talk about being in awe of something? I just hung out with her and fed her some carrots and some mints, and I was just like, oh my God, this is, I never want this to end. It was so
spectacular. I completely agree. You and I are alike. I don't get starstruck by people, but I have been starstruck by horses many, many times.
Yeah, they're just such cool animals. And she was like, she was just this beautiful, real pretty face, just real docile and quiet. And you just say to yourself, wow, when she goes on a racetrack, she is completely, she's an absolute gorilla. She's a beast when she goes onto the racetrack. So, yeah.
And it's so funny because, like, during that race, I would not have been disappointed either direction. I mean, it was either one of those horses or
I was disappointed.
But I mean, you can't take it away. Gary's an excellent jockey. Mike Smith is an excellent jockey. They're both phenomenal. I mean, it was one of the few races that you look at like, you know, it's too bad somebody has to come in second.
Yeah.
Because they were both phenomenal, and as you said, it comes down to a head bob in some cases.
I have two pictures hanging in my house of horses, my own. I have a pencil drawing, an absolute beautiful pencil drawing of Funnyside. My friend Pat Collins' niece, Mary, drew it for me. It's spectacular. And then I have two actual photographs. One of the Belmont Stakes in 1989 with Easy Goer beating Sunday Sounds. When I was a kid, it was all about Easy Goer. And then right next to that, there's a picture of Songbird winning the Cotillion as a three-year-old. And it's just it's a great picture of her coming out of it's blacked out in the back, and it's just her and the Fox Hill red and white, and Mike on top of her with her ears pinned, ready to turn for home and just explode away from the field. So yeah, they'll do that to you, man. Them, my Mets, you know, you become fans too. And then most people in horse racing were fans before they were anything else, which is really the beauty. But I think that's why there's that accessibility you were talking about as well, because, you know, you don't, if you happen to make money in this game, you're very lucky. But you don't do it for money. You do it because, you know, it's what you love, right? It's the old adage. If you can go to work doing what you love, if you go to a job you love, you never work a day in your life. Well, that's what most people in horse racing feel.
And it's kind of, you know, it's very similar to like what we do. I mean, you know, it's kind of funny. I was talking to a friend of mine earlier today, and he was laughing about this show, and he's like, it's a perfect job for you. You sit around, you talk to people. Because that's the one thing you're good at. So shifting gears, I would love to talk about favorite restaurants. And we've briefly touched on this, some of the obvious ones. But let's kind of go down, you know, what were some of yours like growing up? Like, what are some of yours now? I mean, I know the King of Burgos, but I mean, I know you're more widely versed than just that.
Yeah, I've been very I'm talking about my other favorite subject now, food. We'll probably run out of time before talking about Nicole, but those are my favorite subjects: the Mets, food, horses, and Nicole. When I was a kid, so the whole King Umberto's thing, 40. We've been going to King Umberto's 40 years, and we talk about them ad nauseum at this point. But if you're ever in New York, you got to get to King Umberto's. Go see Johnny for a couple of slices. Chito for a table for the food. The Capellini cakes, the greatest appetizer of all time. I've been very fortunate. The other Italian place that I love on Long Island is a place called Steve's Pickle La Bussola. It's in Westbury. It's about 20-25 minutes from from Belmont, and Steve, the owner, used to own horses and stuff, probably been going there 35 years. And I'll tell you a funny story about them. So they make fried mozzarella, but they don't make it like in carrozza or sticks. They make these little mozzarella balls. And I take a couple of my friends, sisters, Fiona and Stephanie, to dinner one night. And Fiona is well at the time, and she's had a family since, so I don't know if she's still over there. She was Dave Matthews' chef from the Dave Matthews Band.
Okay.
And literally, like all the Dreaming Trees videos, Chef Fiona, like that's my friend Fiona Bohan. And so we go to Steve's Pickle of Boussola, and Fiona was a vegetarian at the time. But, you know, she was eating fish and stuff. So we have the baked clams, and we have everything.
I'm a vegetarian, too. I just eat chicken, fish, and beef.
Yeah. So she's eating these fried mozzarella balls, and she's like, this is really interesting. I was like, yeah.
I'm not a vegan.
I gotcha. Just a mini mozzarella stick. And, so, you know, among all the other fantastic dishes Steve has, you know, some shrimp frances, the linguine and my clam sauce, we do everything, you know. And her sister Stephanie, who's one of my best friends, where her and I are eating like we're going to the chair. We got our chicken parm, we got our chicken scaparello, you know, sausage and pepper appetizer, the whole thing. So we go, we eat. About a year later, Dave Matthews comes to Jones Beach, which is the major beach in Long Island. And there's an amphitheater there. So, we, you know, Fiona used to get us tickets all the time, go backstage. So I'm sitting there and I'm eating dinner and we're eating with the band. And Fiona's like, I got a surprise for you. And she added the fried mozzarella balls to her repertoire. And they're out of this world. And I'm sitting down eating dinner, minding my own business. And somebody sits down next to me and says, thanks for these mozzarella balls. And I look to my left and Dave Matthews is sitting there.
That's hilarious.
20 minute conversation with Dave Matthews, bunch of pictures. You know, do you want me to sign anything? I was like, no, this is great. Just having the pictures and the memories more than enough for me. I don't need an autograph. He's like, yeah, you got any other appetizers for me? This is my favorite thing Fiona makes now. So it's like, how cool is this? I got one of the most famous musicians in the world, one of my favorite musicians, and all because I love Steve's Pickle of Boussola and the mozzarella balls. I'm hanging out for a half hour before the show. You know, he asked me what I wanted to hear. I said, I want to hear Don't Drink the Water Tonight. It wasn't on the set list. And he literally goes on stage. He's like, this is for my man Anthony and the fried mozzarella balls. Anything they do, Don't Drink the Water. I mean, it's a real cool experience. All because I'm fat.
It isn't even that. You know what it is? It's, again, accessibility. The guy's obviously down to earth, no different than Donnie Wahlberg, no different than Bob Baffert. It's amazing how many times you come across these people. Toby Keith was like that. Jimmy Buffett was like that. I mean, John Bon Jovi was like that. Everybody that meets these people, there's the common thread is that they're gracious, they're kind, and they genuinely want to meet their fans and people.
Yeah.
And there's something to being genuine that they, you know, they say that, you know, kids and, you know, and dogs can sense, you know, genuineness, but I think a lot of other people can too. And I think that's really cool. I mean, it's something I've experienced many times and it always surprises me, but at the same token, you know, just like you. So what was the name of the restaurant again, where you met him?
I didn't meet him there. Steve's Pickle of Boussola is where I took Chef Fiona. I'll give you one more Italian place on the island. Anthony's of Belmore. My friend Anthony Brew owns the place. He makes a pounded out veal chop with mutz, marsala sauce, and spinach. And he blends it. He doesn't stuff. He blends it before he stuffs the veal chop. And it's just like, it's absolutely to die for. So those are my Italian joints.
Let me ask you this. What are your go-to places in Saratoga?
So I don't really spend as much time up in Saratoga anymore. I spent a lot of time at a place called Prime. It's on the golf course. And Devin Manns and the team over there do a sensational job. One of my favorite appetizers of all time, a surf and turf tempura. They would take filet mignon and lobster and roll it in a sushi roll and then deep fry it in tempura and serve it with this wasabi soy sauce. And when I tell you I could eat 10 of them before getting into the best seafood salad roll you'll ever eat in your life, I'm not exaggerating.
So I have one along that line.
That's my Saratoga spot now.
So if you're ever in Lexington, Kentucky, you have to go to Malone's. And they make...
Took me to Malone's. Love Malone's.
Crab Rangoon Roll Appetizer.
Huh.
And it's very similar. It's a crab rangoon. It's basically rolled tempura style and fried, and it's served with this red chili sauce. And I'll tell you how good this is. I have a real good friend of mine. His wife, beautiful woman, she agreed to do some modeling for me with one of the companies that I represented because we had no budget and I needed a pretty girl to stand next to the horse fence. So she agrees to come to Kentucky and be the model for this thing. So I take her and her husband and Michael Blown and his wife, and I believe Gracie was with me, and we all go to dinner. She has, I don't know, gluten or some allergy. It might have been an allergy to shellfish. But anyhow, we ordered that the first night. She tries it, gets violently ill. I mean, to the point where the next morning, we had to reschedule the shoot to give her time to rally. We go back to the same restaurant the next night with a different group of people, and trying to give her a break and not embarrass her, I said, well, hey, Jessica, why don't you pick the appetizer. So I thought she'll pick something she's not allergic to. She picks the exact same thing. And I look at her and kind of like, are you kidding me? And she goes, it's just that good.
Yeah. I mean, so there's the sacrificing for the greater good. I'm all for that.
Yeah. We can relate.
Yeah, I got a
so
Chinese
I got to run
place
down, and
you
you're probably going to get sick of me talking about this, but I get, you know, my favorites of all time, number one, top of the list, is the Palm. I will go on record as saying I liked it better when the Bozzi family owned it, but I'll always love it. It's like my second home. Second behind that would be Anthony's Runway 84 that you and I have gone to. We've talked about that before.
Yeah.
And then Steve Moriano's place in Fort Lauderdale, and he's got restaurants in Jersey and Philly, correct?
Yeah, Steve Moriano's. There's one in Harrah's. I've been to the one in Harrah's in Atlantic City. Excellent. I mean, great meat.
And what a great story too. And again, nobody's sponsoring us. We are not getting paid to do this. I'm joined by Anthony Big Ace DeBeal, Hollywood and Horsepower today. We're talking about our favorite places that we like to go after the races, before the races, or just on a Tuesday. Steve Morgano's is one of those places. And, you know, I was reading about this. He started out making sandwiches and then later entrees out of his basement in Philly.
Yeah, crazy. It's a crazy story. It really
is. And he still is in the kitchen. 9 times out of 10, if you go in the restaurant in Fort Lauderdale, you'll see Steve standing there.
That's, you know, when it's your passion and you can be successful at it, I think there's this degree of gratitude that, again, I'm sure the same way I'll crack open my racing form and put my headset on and get ready to read the changes every morning before the races at Finger Lakes. I'm sure, you know, when he's making them, when he's got his gloves on and he's got his hands in 5 pounds of chopped meat and he's making his meatball recipe, it's got to be the same thing. It's got to be.
Absolutely. And I would say the other common thread is the graciousness. He's another guy that if you walk in his restaurant, and he's never seen you before in your life, he will stop and take the time to talk to you.
Supposed
just
to.
One of the most gracious, down-to-earth, nice guys you ever met in your life. He is one of those guys that you're actually, you are happy to see him doing well. He deserves it.
Right. Yep. Absolutely.
I mean, I say deserves it, but he's earned it. You know, it's amazing. I always say it's amazing how many times, you know, good luck follows an awful lot of hard work. And most of these guys that I have seen in the restaurant industry, and I'm sure you agree, doesn't matter if it's King Umberto's, Steve Moriano's, or, you know, Gigi's in Chicago, you know, the one thing you see is the owner is there every day.
Rosario has been at King Umberto's for 40 years. And
yeah,
there are very, it's very rare. If you won't walk in and get the kiss on the cheek, you ask, you okay? Where is he? What's he doing? No, he's in the back. He's fine. Well, you know, grandkids had a party today. The girls in a recital. Okay. All right. It's unnerving when you don't see them. So yeah. It's, you know, a lot like that with, like I said, Steve Ficklebusla. Steve lives six blocks from me here in Howard Beach. And mom called him the other day, and he doesn't get to the restaurant much. He's in his early 80s, and he doesn't get to the restaurant lunch anymore, but he still gets there once a week. And he makes sure to see the salad dressing has the right amount of anchovy in it, and he makes sure that the Franchise sauce is thicker than most people's because it's supposed to be thicker. It's not supposed to be a running lemon sauce. It's supposed to be a thick butter and lemon sauce. So, you know, these guys and these gals stay on top of their product, and then it's their name. And, you know, he puts his name on it. Steve's Pickle of Busla, his name's on his restaurant. So
tell me a little bit about that. You touched on Howard Beach, where you live now, where you grew up. For people that don't or haven't been fortunate enough to go to New York City or go through Howard Beach, Queens, give people a little feeling of what it like was growing up there. My feeling with Howard Beach, it's funny. I tell people all the time when they ask about New York City, I say, New York to me is like a bunch of small towns pushed together. So it's like, you know,
good way to put
Queens.
That's a good way to put it. You know, it's funny. So I've lived in the same house my whole life. This is the family house. House was built in 1958.
Which is very common. A lot of people do.
Well, it used to be a lot more common. It's not as common as it used to be, unfortunately. The world's taken a big left-hand turn. Howard Beach was known for being the mafia capital of the world.
It's also, you know, family, the Italians.
Right or
you
wrong.
Know, there's a...
Yeah. It's a heavy, but that's, but I mean, but you know, we'll call a spade, that's what it was known for, home of John Gotti. And, you know, John was arrested and sentenced in 1992, and this neighborhood was never the same, passed away 10 years later, and the neighborhood was never the same. It was predominantly Italian, some German. There's two sides to Howard Beach. There's the side, the main drag here is called Cross Bay Boulevard. It runs about 7 miles. It changes names to Woodhaven Boulevard when you get to the Woodhaven section of Queens. But there is on the east of Cross Bay Boulevard is the old side, which was established in the late 1800s. And then they started building the newer houses on the west side in the 1940s. We have one of the houses. My house was built in 1958, and we've been the only people who live here. Mom was born into the house in 60. So
your grandparents lived in that house?
Grandparents built it. Grandpa built it.
And for a lot of people that don't, just during the show, we're with Anthony Big Ace DeBeale, talking about, you know, restaurants, Howard Beach, Queens, New York. For a lot of people that have never been there, that is very common, especially not just with us. I mean, I'm Italian, you're Italian. But I mean, with Italians, you know, it was very common that, you know, your family is really close-knit. I grew up, you know, we moved and we lived across the street from my grandparents so that they could stay in their house. I ended up living
with my
right around
my
the
grandparents
corner
lived,
so that my parents
my
could stay in their house.
Yeah, my grandparents lived upstairs. We lived downstairs.
Yeah, we ate dinner together every night. And that's the way it was family was really a big piece of Howard Beach. And I'm not talking family like Gotti, but But I mean, his family, like, you know, just family.
Well, it's an Italian neighborhood. That's the, you know,
yeah,
the mother, daughter, the mother. And that's what the funny part was. The old side of Howard Beach were a lot of ranches. And then they built a lot of two family, a lot of mother, daughters on this side. And it was a lot of mother, daughter, you know, two families where it's the son and the parents. The son's downstairs with his family. The parents are upstairs with their family, or, you know, back, you know, whatever's left of the family. Great place. It still is. I mean, it's not as safe as it used to be. It's changed a little bit. You know, we never had any 24 hour. There's a 7-Eleven. There's a McDonald's now. This wouldn't have happened 30 years ago. You know, the neighborhood kind of policed itself.
That's an interesting point. You know, growing up there, you walked the streets, you felt completely safe.
Yeah. So I like to smoke cigars. And that habit has been in the last 15 years or so. And I can tell you over the course of the last 15 years, when I first started smoking cigars, I would take my fat man chair and sit in front of the house. And I would feel fine sitting out till 12, 1 o'clock by myself. And now I don't really feel that safe after 9:30, 10 o'clock. Like, you know, you kind of feel like, but I think that's the world. Everything kind of changes. But it's funny because Queens,
it feels
itself,
more random.
Yeah,
it feels like,
bit.
You know, I'm probably safe, but, you know, there's no rhyme or reason to why something happened.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It used to be like, I grew up in Detroit. You know, you were completely safe if you were in certain areas, but you knew you didn't cross the street into this area.
Correct.
You're asking
correct.
For
it. Correct. Howard Beach was different because we're kind of on an island here. Like, it's weird. Well, Queens and Brooklyn are on Long Island. And my neighborhood is as Long Island as it gets. And what I mean by that is, if you go into Queens, my first girlfriend lived in Astoria. That's the Queens you see on TV. That's coming to America. You know, that's Prince Hakeem. That's Eddie Murphy.
No.
That's coming to America. You know, Jackson Heights. That's what you see. My neighborhood, you'll see, I got 7 parking spots in front of my house. That's not Queens. That's Long Island. That's not Queens. So I literally live, you know, I've hit wiffle balls onto the Belt Parkway from my yard. So I'm right off. But whereas Long Island, excuse me, as it gets. And a couple of weeks ago, you know, as I've been spending half my week in the antithesis of Queens, Farmington and Victor, New York, are as far away from Queens, only 340 miles. It might as well be 340 light years away. And you know, when you first go to a place, you see to yourself, this could be different. You know, and even though I'm 47 years old, I still have these aspirations to settle down and maybe even have a kid. You say to yourself, wow, the city's so hard. It's horrible to raise kids in the city now, and the politics, and it's dirty, and it's not as safe as it used to be, even my neighborhood, which is very expensive too, as you would imagine. You know, all that was is like, well, how do you? Well, maybe I'm supposed to be up here, and you know that kind of wanes off when you can't find a slice of pizza for 40 miles, and you can't find a.
I'm picturing the David Spade and Farley doing the cow tipping in Tommy Boy.
Yeah, it's Tommy Boy. It's very good. It's a good degree of Tommy Boy to it. And I remember about a month ago, 5 weeks ago at this point, I came home on Wednesday night like I always do. And me and Mom were going to see the Mets play the Phillies on a Thursday night. And I had a couple of doctor's appointments, and I had to take another friend of mine. She had to take her to one of her doctor's appointments. And they were all in Queens. And they were all in various parts of Queens. And I'm, you know, here I am, got my Met hoodie on, Met hat on, tilted a little sideways. I got my LL Cool J on the radio, you know, getting ready to take on the big bad Phillies on a Thursday night at Citi Field. And I'm just driving around, and I go to Bayside to go to my first doctor. And I go to Forest Hills to go to my second doctor. Mom's not listening, so I can tell you I sneak in a slice over in Forest Hills. I grab a slice from Daphne's Pizza, and I'm driving. I'm going to pick up my friend Gaetano to take her to the doctor, and I'm like, how the hell am I ever going to leave Queens? In 2000, I'm going to show you what kind
of... Here's New York as it gets.
Yeah, when people say melting pot, right, and they call Queens the melting pot, I was an enumerator for the 2010 United States Census. As that sounds pretty funny that they're letting me fingerprint people, of all people. I was an enumerator for that census. And when we went to the meeting and they gave us our areas, you have these pamphlets and these flyers that help people pick out their language if you cannot communicate with them verbally. They will pick out a language and then you can give them. When I ask people to guess how many different languages and dialects I had in my car, they don't come within 50. I had 192 different pieces of paper in my car with 192 different languages and dialects spoken in Queens alone.
And I love that. And I think that's part of what makes it. I mean, we're Italian. I love the Italian heritage. I, for one, and we can do this on another show because we're running out of time here, but I, for one, have always loved the Gotti family. I always liked John. I admire, you know, I'm not saying he was a saint, but he definitely did a lot of good. But with that being said, I've always liked that melting pot mentality. I like the different cultures. One of the things, you know, I'm a Miami guy. I love Miami. Miami feels more like home than any place else these days. And one of the things I like is kind of what you're describing. You can walk down the street and get a slice. You can go to a little hole in the wall that's a great Argentine restaurant. You can go to the best steakhouse. You can go to the best seafood.
That's a story. That's a story in Jackson Heights. The girl, my first girlfriend, when I was at the New York Post, she lived in Astoria, and it was like, you can go get a slice. You walk into a Greek place where the shrimp, the heads are still on
that's
the
amazing.
Shrimp. You go to a soap block. I remember one time she said to me, she's like, I hope we're as rich as this halal guy one day. She didn't know that halal was like kosher cooking. And we joked about it for a long time. I was like, you're kidding me. I was like, that's a preparation of food. Like that's like a Muslim way to prepare food. Like, you know, that's not, but like, you know, you got the halal trucks on the corner. You got the dirty water dog guy selling the pretzels and the knishes. Like, that's Queens.
Yeah, and you
that's
can't
Queens.
You can't replicate that. Maybe it is
no. The
dirty water. I don't know what it is, but there's
like
a hot dog off a cart in New York tastes different than a hot
you
dog off
fake
a cart
it.
Anywhere.
You just can't fake it. And I'm thinking I'm going to move to Farmington. A shot am I.
I can't picture you up there.
No.
Well, hey, we're coming to the top of the hour here. I really appreciate you joining me. We got to do this again and talk about it more. We say it every time. The next time we're going to talk more about Howard Beach, and we definitely have to do that.
You got to talk.
This is the Hollywood and Horsepower Show. We want to remind everybody, take a minute, go look at No Fallen Heroes, get involved. If you can't do a lot, do what you can. The other thing I always promote on here is oldfriendsequine.org. Michael Blowen does an amazing job, and his team, it isn't just Michael anymore, it's a complete, huge staff, and they do a phenomenal job. And if you are curious at all about horse racing and you're in the Lexington area, that's a great place to go. It's one of the only places you can get face-to-face with a Kentucky Derby winner and feed him a carrot. Did you hear that they actually got Big Brown there now?
Yeah.
So 2008 so
Kentucky
cool.
Derby winner.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's just a fun place to go, and you'll never meet it. Talk about gracious. Michael was an entertainment writer for the Boston Globe. He's going to come on. I was actually talking to him earlier today, and we're going to have him on the show and talk about the old days in Hollywood soon. So I really appreciate you joining us. I love talking to you, your family. Looking forward to spending Thanksgiving with you.
Can't wait.
Give my best to your mother.
I will. Talk to you soon.
And I can't thank you enough.
Anytime.
You're one of the best. This is Hollywood and Horsepower. We thank you for joining us. And when you're in Miami, check out the Palm. If you're in New York, you have to go to King Umberto's. You are robbing yourself if you don't. Don't waste your time going to some tourist trap. Go to the off-the-beaten-path small mom-and-pop family-owned restaurant. You'll be glad that you did. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll see you again next week.